Today's Teisho will be on case 69 in the Book of Serenity, Nanchuan's Cows. Introduction. Becoming a Buddha and being a patriarch, a founder, is disliked for wearing a defiling name. Wearing horns and fur is pushed to the superior position. This is why the true light doesn't shine, great wisdom appears foolish. There is yet another who is deaf for convenience and pretends not to be skillful. Do we know who he is? Case. Nanchuan said to the assembly, "The Buddhas of past, present, and future do not know it is. Cats and cows know it is." Verse, limping and palsied, tattered and disheveled. 100 can't be taken, 1 isn't worth it. Silent, knowing himself the piece of his state. Ebullient, who says in his guts he's a fool? All throughout the universe everything becomes your food. Nose hanging all the way down, one may freely eat to fullness. Well, this is the last day of our January 2007 session, and I just wanted to say that you're doing a wonderful job. Everybody's done a wonderful job, and I'm very happy to be here with you practicing. In fact, it's like my dream come true to be practicing with all of you. Maybe the dream of many lifetimes, even. So, thank you for making such a wonderful effort. We have a little less than a day left of this precious session, and I'm very eager to get back on the cushion and meditate some more, to tell you the truth. I really do enjoy sitting. it's just the darndest thing, you know, because I got up this morning and was sitting on the cushion, and around the second set, I just thought to myself, I am so happy. I love this. This is just great, you know. And I get up quite often in the morning at my home and meditate. And please understand the spirit in which this is offered. This is not at all about me personally. It's really not. As Genki Roshi used to say, if I can wake up, anybody can wake up. So it's not about me. I'm a very typical human being, right? I had the good luck, or whatever you want to call it, to stumble into Zen. And I was an unhappy person, to say the least. I was a depressed and an angry young man. And I had many destructive personal qualities and so on. And left to my own devices, I don't know what would have happened to me. But I stumbled into Zen as I read some books that got me interested, and then I had the incredible good fortune to meet my teachers, who were very noble, kindly people. Incredible, incredible good fortune. And little by little, Zen made my life a whole lot better. So this is, please understand the spirit in which when somebody in our group said to somebody else in our group, "I hate it when he talks about how much he likes to sit, you know, or how much he enjoys sitting, you know." And it probably does. It never occurred to me that it probably, it might, maybe it seems like boasting or something, you know, but But it's not, I don't mean it that way. I honestly don't. It's not a personal attribute. You know, it's not a personal attribute. It's just something that I do that I love, you know. And so what I'm trying to share is just the fact that I love this, you know. And that it seems... I mean, I wouldn't want to recommend something to other people that I didn't think helps me, right? I wouldn't want to say to somebody, you should do this, when I myself wouldn't do it, right? And I also think that people have a big misunderstanding about Zen practice, you know. I think that many people believe, not just in the United States, but many people believe that Zen is about being like, you know, tough, unfeeling, you know, totally remote from all human concerns. And, you know, we have those sorts of images of Zen masters as these remote people who are, you know, very inscrutable and a little bit terrifying, you know. And I have known a number of people, a number of Zen masters, and none of them have been like that, you know. They've all been funny, kindly, human beings, you know. Genki Roshi was like that. Webb was like that. And they were like grandmotherly in their kindness, you know. I just want to make sure everybody understands that Zen is not about, you know, as I said yesterday, it's not about being tough. It's not about having an iron will. That's pointless. It's about embracing life fully with an open heart and with trust, you know. And so that's one of the reasons I say, boy, I had a great sit this morning, because I want you to understand that Zen is not about suffering, right? That's not the point. And at some point, suffering is just not there. It's just, you know, I mean, like everybody else, I get up in the morning sometimes and I have sore legs this morning. You know, this is day 7 of the sesshin, and I'm, you know, my legs are a little tired, you know. And so, you know, today, sometimes when I get up and sit, you know, my legs are fresh and it's great, you know. But today there was a strain, you know. And so, like everybody else, I'm feeling the aches and pains, but boy, that feeling of, you know, just that joy, you know, that joy. There's nothing to do. It's not my personal possession. It's just something I stumbled into in my life, and it's something anybody can have access to if you practice this beautiful path, you know. And enlightenment itself is like that, just so everybody understands. Enlightenment is not a personal quality or property that somebody owns, right? So we often say, he's an enlightened master, right? But actually, this is like a misstatement. Because enlightenment is not a personal quality. It's a state of awareness in which you perceive the fundamental reality of things, right? And you can enter that state of awareness. People blunder into that state of awareness, right? You do koans and you have a little glimpse of something. You know, each koan is like, as I've mentioned this before, but each koan is like the blind man and the elephant. Right, you know, so there's the parable. It comes out of India, and it's a Buddhist parable about what it means to experience enlightenment. And enlightenment is so vast that most people can't grasp it all at once, you know, and they need a little help. So what happens with koan training is the koan shows you a certain aspect of enlightened mind. Or it gives you a glimpse of enlightened awareness. And basically the blind men all try to know the elephant, and one blind man grabs the leg of the elephant and says the elephant's like a tree. And another blind man, you know, grabs the tail and says, no, the elephant's like a snake, you know. And somebody else grabs the ear and says it's like a, you know, it's like a banana leaf, you know, and so on. So they all have a different impression of the elephant, and you know, this is how koan training works. It like shows you a piece of the elephant, a little piece, and gradually you put it all together. And you go through this process for years and years, and then people have what we call in Zen Dai Kensho, or great awakening. Usually people have little Kensho experiences, or Kensho experiences, where you see something of the elephant, it's like you're sitting there, you get a glimpse of the elephant, and then your mind sort of closes back up because of your mental habits. And then you think, did that really happen? You know? And then, you know, it happens again, and you think, wow, that was something, but then it's gone after a month or two, and it closes up, you know. So this goes on for a while, and eventually you have what's called Dai Kensho, which is where you see the elephant, right, and it's not there and gone, it's there, you know, and you cry or whatever, you know, it's pretty amazing. And basically, it's the most wonderful thing in the world, but it's not your personal possession. And after Dai Kensho, you can get back there all the time. It's always there, but it's like climbing up a ladder up to another floor of a building, you know. That sort of Zen practice becomes like getting on a ladder and climbing up. And if you climb up the ladder and you go up into that room, you spend a lot of time there, you know, ideally, you become, if you really try, you become a little better person, right? You know, become a little kinder, a little more patient, a little less frightened. You know, somebody like the Dalai Lama is really he's a genuine article, you know. Somebody like Mr. Goenka, there's a genuine article, you know. These people have all climbed up the ladder, and they spend a lot of time up there, and they become really good people, you know. But enlightenment is not their personal property or quality of them personally. This is very important to understand. I had a great, to make a long story short, I had a great sit. The more I do Zen, the more I love it. Just the truth. I literally sometimes get out of bed and I can't wait to sit. I swear that's true. And I can't wait to, it may sound hard to believe, especially on the last day of a sesshin, but I can't wait for sesshin. You know, I feel happy just thinking about an approaching sesshin. And I know, let me just say, 30 years ago it wasn't like that. You know, the thought of an approaching sesshin was kind of vaguely like, it was terrifying. You know? But it's not now. It's not now. I just wanted you to understand that someday it won't be if you keep practicing, and it just gets better and better. And you know, years ago I was reading this wonderful book called what is it called? It's got a really boring title, but it's like The Institution of Chan Buddhism in China. And it's by an anthropologist named Holmes Welch. But he did a lot of research on Buddhist monasteries and convents before the Cultural Revolution. And he interviewed lots of men and women who were part of that world. And there was one group of men who had been at one particular monastery. And they were known as the old papayas, you know. You know, we have papaya every day for breakfast. I hope you have noticed, you know. It's delicious, right? And it doesn't really have anything to do with the story. It's just that we do have papayas. And they're good, aren't they? And they're good for your digestion. And they have more vitamin C than orange juice. So think about that. But anyway, these monks were called the old papayas. Yeah, and they were called the old papayas because they had Dai Kensho long ago. And they just, and they had been sitting, they were, you know, they were, they'd had Daikensho 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And the interviewer, the anthropologist Holmes Welch, said, so you just keep doing meditation, doesn't it get boring? You know, you've done this for 50 years. They looked at him like he was crazy, right? They did. And they said, are you kidding? They said, we can't wait to get up in the morning. So we have our rice and we hit the cushion, you know? We can't wait. And they laughed. They said, you know, if this isn't your cup of tea, being in a Zen monastery is like being in prison, you know? But they said, if this is where you want to be, you know, this is heaven, you know? So, anyway, if you keep practicing, it just gets better and better. And I had a wonderful sit today, and it makes it especially wonderful that I'm here with all of you, and it's great. This is just great. This is like my dream come true. I'm able to practice with all of you. And so it's now day 7 for those who came last Sunday, and it's day 5 for those who came on Tuesday night. A number of people here went through the first 7-day sesshin, and that is really an achievement. That's something to be really proud of. Chan Chi? Is that right? Chan Chi. That's a classic 7-day Chan Zen retreat. Chan Chi. It might interest you to know that people, followers of the way, Fo Zhao, have been doing Chan Chi for thousands of years. Think about that. People have been following this beautiful path for thousands of years. Right? And they've been getting up 4:30 in the morning and doing just what we do. This is a wonderful path, and you've completed your first 7-day sesshin, and you should feel wonderful about that. And other people have had the opportunity to come here from their busy lives and overwhelming lives at some time to sit in a Buddha mind, an enlightened mind, for 5 days and enjoy the spaciousness and happiness of that perspective, that reality. And that's wonderful. I'm so glad you could come here for these precious days. And finally, I want to thank the beginners in our group who have done such a fantastic job. And it's just really awe-inspiring to see people who are able to sit so ably on their first attempt. It's just really quite impressive and very unlike my experience. So that's just great. So this koan today is quite an important koan, I think, if you are interested in practicing the way of Zen. Nan Chuan said to the assembly, "The Buddhas of past, present, and future do not know what it is. Cats and cows know what it is, or know what it is." Now, this is interesting, right? Because when we think about Buddha, we might think of the Buddha as all-knowing, you know, and so on. But what he says here is that basically the Buddhas of past, present, and future don't know it, but cows and cats know it. You know. One day we were practicing Zen at our temple up in the mountains outside of Seattle. Our temple was known as Tokuganji. And we bought 30 acres of land, I'm sorry, 50 acres of land, in the eastern part of Washington State, which is beautiful. It's like a desert. It's like probably like parts of India. It's like high desert, mountains, and it's not, you know, there's trees, but they're like cedar-type trees. Up in the mountains, it's like Colorado. It's like a alpine country. And we bought for the for like a ridiculously little amount of money at that time, like $80,000. We bought this property that looked out for like 100 miles. And not only that, but it was right next to a national park. So we were surrounded by land that could never be, no housing development. And it was just wonderful. But we were a poor Zen group, and we had very little money, and so we were building our temple like 1 2-by-4 at a time. Right? It was like that, you know, somebody would donate money for a roof, and we would put a roof on, you know. And then somebody would donate money for windows, and we would put windows in, right? So at one time, we could only have sesshin up there 3 times a year because it was so cold in the winter. And even in the fall, there would be snow. And I'm not kidding, we all used to sleep in our tents, and Dokusan, we had Dokusan in a camping tent for a while. And then later we had it in the kitchen. The kitchen was detached from the sitting hall. It was actually laid out somewhat like a Japanese or Chinese temple in its ground plan. And so these were separate buildings. And I can remember sitting in the Dokusan line and watching the snow build up on the shoulders of the person in front of me. I was thinking about that the other day, and I thought, God, did I really do that? You know? But I did. It didn't bother me at all. It was the most wonderful thing, you know? Anyway, we were sitting in the Zendo, and we had no windows. And our property was right next to the National Forest, and the National Forest leases its land to ranchers out west. This is a common arrangement. They let ranchers run their cattle on public land to graze, and basically the herdsmen go up in the spring and wrestle all the doggies and bring them in. That's what they do. So we were, you know, the cows would be drifting up through our property some mornings, and we were sitting in the Zendo, and of course we're all working on the Mu Koan, right? You can see where this is going. And we're all sitting there on the cushion going, oh, oh, oh. And then, you know, of course, Mu. It was like, and you know, everybody, you know, just burst into laughter because it was so, you know, amazing, right? It was just, we're all sitting there calling Moo, and the cow goes Moo. You know? And we all laughed, and then Genki Roshi said, you know, I want you to understand that there's one difference between your Moo and the cow's Moo. That is, yours is so self-conscious. It's like, wow, you know, that's so, we always think of ourselves as superior, or, you know, modern people, and in pretty much everywhere, and Western people, think of ourselves as superior to animals. So, you know, naturally, a cow is almost like a comical animal in the West. It's, we eat them, they're not very bright, we think, and so on. So that was really kind of a shocker, you know. He said, you know, the cow's moo is better than yours, because a cow is not self-conscious. And he didn't mean it as an insult. He was just pointing out something that's true, you know. And I've never forgotten that, because, you know, the more I go on, the more I realize that Genki Roshi was right, you know. Zen is you know, it's easy to misunderstand, as I was saying, many aspects of Zen practice. You can think, for example, that Zen is about suffering and pain, being in pain and toughing it out. You can also think that Zen is about strength of will, you know. And I think both of those are mistaken. You know, if you wanted me to say what is Zen about, you know, in one word, I could say Zen is about being natural, in many different ways, you know, being natural. Zen is about connecting with the natural way of life. It's also about connecting with nature itself, you know. And I think that you can experience this in various ways, you know, yourself. I when I sit on a cushion, I often feel the same way I do on the cushion as when I'm out in the mountains hiking. You know, I get that same feeling. It's like everything I look at is like it feels like my home, or feels there's something. If you're a nature lover, you know, and you go out into the trees and the forests hiking, you know, there's something about it. It's hard to put your finger on. It's hard to offer a reason or an explanation, but you just feel a sense of like harmony or connectedness with things, you know. And this is true for sitting. It's pretty much the same feeling I get when I'm sitting on the cushion. You know, I've just had that insight over and over again in my life that this is so much like being in the, it's like finding the mountains inside yourself, you know. And that seems sort of like wishful thinking, right? That might seem like a coincidence or a poetic connection, but I don't think it is. I think nature really is deeply inside of ourselves, you know. I mean, we're part of the natural world, and we evolved over millions of years. Our consciousness has been shaped by this natural world. And there's a kind of a harmony we experience under certain circumstances, you know. And I think it's hardwired into us. And the process of living in a very artificial civilization sort of takes us away from that, you know. Psychologists have done studies, and they found that, you know, that humans all over the world, when asked to identify, and from very different cultures, when shown pictures of places and said, which of these would you feel most comfortable in? It's interesting that humans all over the world, whether they live in the desert, in the mountains, you know, wherever they live, they tend to pick the same place. And they often, it's interesting that they often, according to this article I was reading, they often pick a place that's in like the trees, but it looks out on an open area, and there's some water nearby. So it would be like you're looking through trees, there's a little stream running, or there's a lake, and you're looking out at an open space. And apparently humans all over the world find this very comfortable. This is like this is the place where they feel best. And you know, that means that somehow this is like hardwired into us, right? I really believe that. And people have speculated that Zen meditation, early forms of yoga, were came out of hunting behaviors, believe it or not. That when you're hunting, you maintain a vigilant concentration without moving for long periods of time. And there's some evidence that people in that state enter kind of altered consciousness, you know. But Zen practice is is natural in a little deeper way also, or some other deeper ways also, I believe. When you're doing Zen practice, there's a way of practicing which is a natural way of practicing. You might come to a sesshin and think, this is it. I'm going to answer my koan. See, I'm going to answer my koan. And I'm going to do it come hell or high water. So you sit up on the cushion, you really make a serious effort, you tough it out, pain, you sit there through the pain, the blistering pain, you know, you might even come in here and do extra sits, you know, move. And then you come into the Dokusan room and, you know, nothing. And it could be very bitter, very disappointing. This is actually quite common, you know. People get worried when they're spending a long time on a koan, and sometimes they feel they have to make like a heroic effort of sort of like self-immolation, burning yourself up on the cushion. The idea is that somehow I'm going to pull this out, you know, by strength of will. And this just, in my opinion, never works. This never works. The other way of doing something doesn't work either, where you just come and say, okay, I'm just going to let, que sera, sera, you know. So when I feel like moving, I'll just move, you know. That doesn't work either, you know. There's got to be a kind of balance between trying and letting go. Trying and letting go. This is, if you don't try, nothing's going to happen. But then you have to let go. There's a kind of middle way between trying too much and not trying enough. And the best word for this middle way is natural. There's a kind of naturalness. There should be a kind of naturalness to Zen practice, to your Zen practice. This means that you don't that you let things develop and grow in a way that feels good, that produces a joy and energy. It doesn't mean it's not challenging, but it produces joy and it produces energy. So, I mean, let's say you leave the sesshin here today, when we end it at 6 or so, and you say, that did it. I'm going to really take Zen seriously. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up at 4:30, and I'm going to sit for 2 hours. Hey, we don't have to find that so funny. So, you know, if you did that for a week, you know, you might quit doing Zen. Or you might develop a nervous twitch or something. You know, people would see and you'd be sort of twitching, you know, like your head would go to one side or something, you know. You might be very edgy, you know, and people, you might snap at people, right, you know. They'd say, what's wrong with you? Shut up! You know? I've been getting up every day and meditating, you know. You know, it just wouldn't be natural, right? It wouldn't be natural. The Chinese have a saying which is so important. It's wu wei, wu wei. This could be translated as effortless effort, right? You try, but you have to go with the Tao. You have to go with the. There's a way in life. I mean, I have such deep respect for Indian culture. And I have such deep respect for Chinese culture and such deep respect for Japanese culture. I've learned so much from all of these cultures. And from Chinese culture, I've learned, you know, Chinese culture has this great wisdom about naturalness. It's so important. It's so important. You know, there's a way of being in harmony with events. And it's not trying to impose your will on them, but to be with the moment. There's a kind of natural harmony with things. The word in Chinese for this is Tao. It's often translated as the way, but it means being in harmony with things. There's a natural flow to events. There's a natural flow, see? And you harmonize yourself with the natural flow. And when you're harmonious, you feel calm, you feel at one with other things. And it's not characterized by a sense of strain or aggression or anger or trying to make things happen. So it's very wise, you know. The Chinese were, in the early period of Chinese culture, even before Buddhism, the Chinese were very close observers of nature, and they noticed the rhythms, and they saw the interconnectedness of things. You know, the Chinese were really brilliant agriculturalists, you know, and And they understood like the natural cycles and the interconnectedness of things. You know, long before Western people knew anything about, say, fertilizing fields, you know, people in Asia knew all about like complex. They didn't have the word ecosystem, but they understood how these things worked. And Chinese have understood this idea: you can't force things. You have to have a kind of natural go with the flow, natural feel to things. You know? I think that people misunderstand Zen as a kind of military regimen. Not so much in our group, but in some places, there's a kind of rigidity to the practice. It's like you're going to force yourself to awaken, and I think this is fundamentally mistaken. That I think the Chinese had a deep understanding of this wu wei, you know, there's a naturalness to things. So, you know, if you say I want to commit myself to a Zen life, I'm going to practice more, it would be better to try, you know. If you do practice now once a week, try twice a week, right? And see how it feels. And if you don't try at all, nothing's going to happen. But if you tried it twice a week for a couple weeks, and you saw how it felt, and it felt good, and you felt energized, and you had a sense of joy, then add another day, see? And add another day, and add another day, and you, in this way, you deepen your practice. You deepen your life, see? And you might get to a point where you're sitting every day. You might even be crazy enough to get up at 4:30 and do 2 hours of Zazen, right? Every day. And you know what? You could love it. You could wind up as an old papaya someday. But if you have to take it one step at a time and feel it out, and it has to be, there has to be this sense of the harmoniousness of things in yourself with your world, and it doesn't mean you can't challenge yourself. You know, a number of people came into Dokusan and said things like this. You know, during the sit I had a lot of pain, but the darndest thing is I feel so happy. You know, right now I just feel so happy. Well, I think that's harmony with the Tao. See, I don't think harmony with the Tao means never do anything that's challenging or difficult. I think harmony with the Tao means that the test is how you feel about things. Are you calmer? When you get off the cushion, is your mind... See, I mean, one of the interesting things about Zen practice, and it's true, it's like, as Shen Yang says, bitter practice, sweet mind. You know, you sit on the cushion, and you're struggling to focus, and things aren't going right, and your legs hurt, and then you get off the cushion, and you're so happy. See, that's bitter practice, sweet mind. I think that's in harmony with the Tao. That's harmony with the flow of things. The test is how you feel. See, the test is that there's a sense of naturalness, or are you more calm? Do you feel more connected? Are you more compassionate? Are you more patient? You know, are you more kindly? And are you more aware? See? At the end of a sesshin, you know, people's senses are, because we've been purifying body, mind, and heart for 5 days or 7 days, we're very sensitive, right? So sounds seem very crisp and clear, very beautiful. We can, when you think of somebody, you know, this all the time it happens to me that people come into Dokusan and they'll say, you know, this morning I was sitting and I thought of my brother and I realized I'm going to call him as soon as sesshin is over and tell him I love him. I haven't talked to him in 3 years. You know, and that's Tao. That's the Tao. That's harmony with the way, see? So there's a, that's working properly. You know, the test is how it feels, how you feel. Are you calmer? Are you more compassionate? And straining isn't the answer, but not trying isn't the answer. So there's a kind of natural balance to things. See, so this Zen is really deeply connected. We live in such a different life, you know, such a different world. This concept of a natural harmony is so far from the way modern people live. But I think when you come to sesshin, you begin to you begin to see it, or you begin to feel it all around you. You know, I see it in people's faces. You know, there's a kind of calm when they come to Dokusan and I look at people's faces. There's a kind of calmness to their faces and a kind of deep relaxation, which is odd because you might have been sitting on the cushion in pain for half an hour, but when you get off the cushion, it's like your deep relaxation, you know, deep calm, deep mental imperturbable mind, you know. Well, at any rate, there's this. This is another way in which Zen practice is natural. But there's another way too that I want to talk about in the remaining few minutes, and that is that our biggest mind is not our conscious mind. It's not. And there's all of this research that proves this recently. You know, that there are even brain researchers recently had a conference, and they were talking about the fact that consciousness is so little a part of the total package of human awareness. That, you know, when you come into a room, you only are conscious of just a few details. But your ears, your smell, your eyes, your whole body is taking in all of this information, and it's not being lost. It's being processed below the threshold of consciousness. You know? Consciousness is like the tip of a giant iceberg, right? In fact, most processing is not conscious. Most information processing isn't conscious. And this is well documented by psychologists. You know? So when we live in a world that's confined to the conscious mind, to rationality, and so on, there's nothing wrong with rationality, but it's like a very unnatural, distorted, and impoverished way to live. You know, so Zen is about getting in touch with that deeper mind. That bigger mind, and it's not a thinking mind. It's a mind we share with cows and cats, and all of these other living beings. You know, and indeed, you could say that when you look at Muxin, when you look at that blankness, you're facing nature itself. You know, this is nature itself. Now, when the little discriminating mind looks at that blankness, it just says nothing's there. Right? But when you begin to enter into that blankness, everything becomes part of your body, really and truly. You know, I mean, one of the great tragedies of human existence, in my opinion, is that we are so unable to understand that we're part of the natural world. I mean, for modern people, nature is just like a repository of goods for our use. It's like a dead. It's like there's no difference between going into a forest and taking down all the trees and going into a clothing store and buying some shirts. Right? They're commodities. They're objects. And this is like a very, very unhealthy mind, in my opinion. And it's a consciousness we've created by living in the small mind too much. Yeah? When you come to Sesshin and you sit at the table and you've just been in deep samadhi, you know, you begin to act in the world in a different way. You know, it's not just you hear the birds singing and you feel like the singing of the birds is coming out of your own body. Or the wind blows and you feel like you're blowing with the wind, you're blowing. You look at a tree and you feel you are the tree. But even the way you deal with like inanimate objects, you know, you can see a difference often. When people come to Sesshin and they open their bowls for the first time, it's like this unholy clatter, right? It's just like, oh my God, you know, it's like everybody just sort of opening the bowls and clatter, 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 clatter. You know? And you can begin to see as people become more alert, more open-hearted, and more sensitive, that they treat their bowls different. You know, people start on doing their bowls more quietly, they're putting them down on the table more gently, because, you know, actually, your bowls are part of yourself too. This is all one life. This is all one life. And so, you know, the unnatural way we live produces this sense that everything is just a dead object, you know. And that comes from living in the small mind. But, you know, when you begin to practice this way of Zen, this way of living in Mushin, you begin to feel your connectedness to everything, even the bowl, even the rice in the bowl. Everything, the whole world is transformed into this beautiful living, this beautiful life, this beautiful living being. You know, it's not a metaphor. This is not flowery language. If you keep walking this path, I swear to you, it'll be as obvious as the clouds in the sky, you know, as obvious as the ground under your feet. That sense of connection just grows and grows and grows. Your body is the whole world, is everybody's body, is everything in the world. And that's the truth. And that's why the old papayas can't wait to get on the cushion, right? Because the boundaries of myself, the boundaries don't, my world doesn't stop with my body, my personal body. It extends in all directions. And every time you sit, you're going beyond those limits, those boundaries, and you're connecting, returning to, I should say, your connection to everything that's alive all around you. And everything springs to life. Everything. Bowls, rice, water. Yeah. No, but this is how it really is. This is what awakening is, you know. The world of nature is everywhere. You know, everywhere. And, you know, people can realize this more or less, right? I mean, people can have a little glimpse of this, or they can have a deep experience of this. And you can keep deepening your experience of this forever and ever and ever, you know. And so it depends on how you want to live, you know. You can decide, I've seen it, been there, done that, you know. You can decide to have a deep life of Zen practice, you know. Whichever you choose is wonderful, you know. And I'm glad to know everybody here. You don't have to ever decide once and for all. You know, the door is always open for you to walk this beautiful path. So, anyway, we have about a little more than 6 hours to become like cats and cows. Yeah, become like the cats and the cows. We're just going to sit in that empty mind, that blank mind, and we're going to feel the connection to everything around us grow and grow, and it'll be wonderful, right? The heaven on earth, heaven, the all, heaven itself, right? So. Nan Chuan said to the assembly, "The Buddhas, past and present, future and future, don't even know what it is. Cats and cows know what it is." Limping and palsied, tattered and disheveled, a man can't be taken. Limping and palsied, tattered and disheveled, 100 can't be taken. 1 isn't worth it. Silent, knowing himself the peace of his state. Ebullient, who says in his guts he's a fool? All throughout the universe, everything becomes your food. See? Everything becomes yourself. Everything becomes your life. See? All throughout the universe, everything becomes food. Everything sustains you. Everything that brings you happiness. This is what happens if you stay in Mushin. Nose hanging down all the way, one may eat freely to fullness. The translation is terrible. One may freely seek to repletion. It's like, oh my God, that's terrible. So. One may eat to fullness, right? One may eat to fullness. So, let's eat to fullness. It's just great.